Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Peter Nash is speaking on David and Absalom, and you thought your kid was bad. So let's listen in on Peter Nash.
Gracious and ever-loving God, no one knows more than you how difficult it is to be a parent, to suffer with children, to watch children make bad choices, or at least different choices, and to have to be confronted, to confront ourselves and our children, and to be confronted by our children. Remind us that in every case there is grace for all parties, for father and son, mother and daughter, in whatever stage we find ourselves. Make us trust in your grace and give us enough love to cover the situations. These things we ask in the name of your Son. This week on David and his sons especially, but it's David and his children. And this one is entitled, David and Absalom, and You Thought Your Kid Was Bad. Yesterday we spent the hour talking about David and Amnon and Amnon's violation of his half-sister and Tamar, and then Tamar's full brother, Absalom, taking revenge 2 years later, having him murdered, and he was in exile for 3 years, and then after that was brought back into the household of the king. Today we're going to look at the story that comes up a couple of chapters later when Absalom, who is now either first or second in line to the throne of David, decides that he's waited long enough and leads a rebellion against his father, temporarily successful rebellion. I want to look at how David reacts to this rebellion. I want to look at what Absalom's charge is against his father, why he's able to, we think of David as the ideal king, and when he's referred to in the Book of Kings, he's always the one against whom all other kings are found measured and found wanting. But why is it that it seems so easy for Absalom to find a large following in this rebellion against his father? Even some of the high officials threw their lot in with Absalom. And then sometime on the relationship, again with David and his children, and do some talking about what it takes to be a good parent in the midst of a world that asks you for many, many things. First, I want to get into the text itself, and I'll just remind you that Absalom has been in exile for several years. And while he was in exile, he made a lot of friends up in this region called Geshur, up north in the north country. Then he's back home in the court. And I'll read the short part and make you read the long part. After this, Absalom got himself chariot and horses and 50 men to run ahead of him. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the road into the gate. And when anyone brought a suit before the king for judgment, Absalom would call out, "From what city are you?" And when the person said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no one deputed by the king to hear you." Absalom said, "Moreover, if only I were judge in the land, then all who had a suit or a cause might come to me, and I would give them justice." Whenever people came near to do obeisance to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of them and kiss them. Thus Absalom did to every Israelite who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the people of Israel. What's going on here?
Well, he was politicking to become the king. Mm-hmm. Was it his idea to overthrow David, or?
I don't know any more than you do.
Because he would have almost had the inside track on becoming king anyway, wouldn't he, with Amnon dead?
He is... There isn't a clear law of succession, but he's the third son. The second son we don't hear anything about. And Amnon, he has already had murdered. So if he just seems, if he were just patient, he would be the king. Maybe he's just trying to set things up so that when David dies...
He hasn't supported the people.
He hasn't supported the people. He's the beloved heir.
Are these 50 men like an army or protection for him?
It's we see this with Saul, too. Just before Saul is anointed king, we hear that he has donkeys and 30 men. It's sort of a retinue, a picture of power and prestige and potential royalty. He already has an estate, a royal estate as the prince. We've seen that both when he murders Amnon and when he sends Tamar back to his house, not back to the king's house. So he's not just waiting on dad for his paycheck, so to speak. What's the complaint? Let's see if we can back into this. Why is he able to be successful with this?
Well, apparently there isn't anyone to hear the complaints of the people, is there? Not all of them get to the king?
Yeah, they're not getting satisfaction from the king. He asked them where they're from, and when they respond, we're from such and such a tribe. There are 12 tribes around the nation. The response is, "Oh, there's nobody here to hear the disputes of Dan today. If I were the judge," I didn't bring my Hebrew Bible today. Judge is a loaded term. It's a they very seldom sit in, if this is the word I expect here, and I didn't check this today, but it's also the term that we use for the military leaders. It was a dual purpose, both political, triple purpose, political, juridical, and military leaders. The whole book of Judges is not so much about people who stood in judgment for the court cases, but the political military leaders. And they're not getting the satisfaction, and so he's saying, if I were the judge, if I were the one in charge, you'd be heard. And then all who had a suit or cause might come to me, and I would give them justice. You can't get justice in this town. Gee, I really feel badly for you. Too bad I can't really help. If I just had a little more power.
You'd have thought that he could have almost acted as a mediator between them and his father.
Yeah, well, that would be a way to go. To be loyal to the father, and to set oneself up as the one who's able to deliver. That's the way it worked in Chicago with dailies.
Sure. Yeah.
Is he back in the good graces of his father this time?
Yeah, what we skipped over is the part where Joab, David's right-hand man, could see that David was longing for Absalom, perhaps thinking about him being the one who's most suited to be the next king. Perhaps it's not said, but that could be what's on his mind. And so he arranges this this meeting where David has sort of like the picture with Nathan after the deal with Bathsheba, where he's sort of backed into a corner and has to be forgiving, or he can save face and be forgiving, and brings him home. But what's not clear is that Absalom has forgiven his father. Dad is willing to bring him back, but Absalom still got this grudge about the dad who did nothing when his sister was raped, because he favored the other son who's not dead. Any other questions or comments come to mind? someone would read 7 through 12 for me, for us.
And at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Pray, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I dealt at Geshur in Aram, saying, 'If the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord.' The king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king at Hebron.' With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their simplicity and knew nothing. And while Absalom was offering the sacrifice, he sent for
Ahithophel,
the Gilonite, David's counselor, from the city of Beth. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing." Is that Gilo?
Gilo, yeah, that's perfect. Now, what's happened here? We've got a conspiracy that's been going on for 4 years. For 4 years, he's been showing up and saying, "Hey, I really feel bad for you. I wish I could help you out. You know, if I were in charge, we'd get something done around here." And then after 4 years, he goes to the dad and says, "Let me go to Hebron." And he said, when I was in exile, I made this this vow, and I need to go pay it now because things are better. And the king says, "Go in peace. You have my blessing." Now, what do we know about Hebron? The people in Hebron are probably still a little miffed because you remember where David was first king in Israel? He was first king of Israel. After Saul's death, he was king in Hebron for 7 years. Hebron was the capital city. Usually the capital city meant no taxes, and all the prestige that goes with in the capital city. So there's probably some disaffection here in Hebron, and it's a very symbolic act to declare oneself king in the very place where the serving king was declared king and reigned for 7 years. Because after 7 years, 7 years after Saul had died, that David moved the capital to Jerusalem. And that was a political move to unify the southern and the northern kingdoms of Israel, Jerusalem being in sort of like a Washington, D.C., a city that didn't belong to either.
Now, like with Hebron and Geshur, were they each different of the 12 tribes in these different areas? Or?
Yeah, so different people would, this is a way of, not unlike sort of putting the map together for the war between the states or the Civil War. You know, which ones do we have to, well, before that, which ones can be slave states, which ones can be free states, so we keep balancing and prevent the war. This kind of thing was going on for much of Israel's history, and it looks like Absalom is doing that. He's got friends up here in Geshur, up in the north country. He's got friends over here, down here in Hebron, down in the southern country. So he makes himself king down there where David, in the area that David is from. Let's see. It's Heshbon, where is he? If you're looking for a good study Bible, I'm going to recommend this one. It's the Oxford Annotated New Revised Standard. It's got great maps in the back for finding these places. Thank you. what's down here in this region in Judah, so to speak.
Okay.
And this is where he did a hard time of being Gesher. And then down here in this section is where he, so this is where he was installed in the kingdom, right smack in Judah territory, populated Judah territory. And we talked about how Absalom had to flee and hid out in this area for several years after he had murdered his, had his brother murdered. So he's making connections in north and south, sort of covering all the bases. So people are coming with him by choice. Some people are coming with him out of simplicity. They don't know about this conspiracy. They're just invited guests. And hey, the king's son is throwing a party. I guess I'll go. I'll show up there. I was talking earlier about my concern about the neglect of power and authority that we all have. Here's a prime example. The next five verses, if someone would read 13 through 18.
And a messenger came to David, saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom." Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down evil upon us. Smite the city with the edge of the sword." And the king's servants said to the king, "Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides." So the king went forth, and all his household after him. And the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. Do you want me to go ahead?
Yeah, two more.
And the king went forth, and all the people after him. They halted at the last house, and all his servants passed by him, and all the Chariotites, and all of the Beliatites, and all of the 600 Gideites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king.
All right. I'll read a little further here. I do want to go a little further because of what happened. This next piece is really nice. The Gittites came with him from Gath. David spent part of his time, this is going way back in David's history now, in the Philistine territory, even fighting for the Philistines at one point as a mercenary. And Gath is in Hittite territory. So 500 of these people had been in David's retinue for several years. And some of them had just come up. And then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why are you coming with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us while I go wherever I can? Go back and take your kinsfolk with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you." But Ittai answered the king. The king. The narrator tells us who the king is. The king doesn't know who the king is as he talks. "As the Lord lives and as my Lord lives, so as Yahweh the God lives and as my Lord the king lives, wherever my Lord the king may be, wherever, whether for death or for life, there also your servant will be." Sounds sort of like the Ruth passage. David said to Ittai, "Go then, march on." So Ittai the Gittite marched on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. The whole country wept aloud as all the people passed by. The king crossed the Wadi Kidron, and all the people moved toward the wilderness. What is happening here? Have you all raised kids? Can you imagine your kid coming in saying, "I'm the dad, I'm the mom," and then just fleeing your house? And the neighbor saying, "Where are you going?" And say, "Talk to mom, talk to dad, talk to the owner of the house." This is just bizarre behavior on David's part. He's He's the mighty warrior. He's the king of the land. And his son gets a few hundred people behind him. Or depends on where you are in the story. At one point, everybody's following Absalom, but on the same page in my translation, everybody's weeping as David goes out. Perhaps they're afraid because there's no one to protect them, and they don't know what's going to go on with Absalom. But he gets word that Absalom has made himself king, and he just kind of collapses and says, well, let's get out of here before we're all killed. The servants say, whatever you decide, we'll do. We'll stay here and fight, or we'll flee with you. But David's response is to leave 10 concubines behind to take care of the household. You got to turn it over and get out of town. This is, to me, is the one of the ultimate applications of power and authority in the entire world, but certainly in the Bible, that God's anointed forgets for a moment that he's the anointed. But interestingly enough for David, even in the midst of forgetting that he's the anointed, he does what he's supposed to do. He looks at Ittai the Gittite and says, you're a sojourner. You can't come out here with me and give up what you have. Stay here where you have some security. He won't be abusive to you. Stay here where you have some security. I'm the one who's going to be in exile now. And he gets the appropriately pious response from the Gittite. But in that moment, even though he's giving up his role as king, he's doing what the king is supposed to do, which is to watch out for the sojourner and the widow and the orphan. He's showing this kindness to Ittai, who has been in his presence for years, apparently. But he can't remember he's the king. He just gives it up and walks out and turns over the palace. And I find this absolutely astounding. Every time I read it. Anything else? Anything come to mind for you, or questions that come up?
How old was David then?
This came up yesterday, and it's just a guess. My guess is that he's in his early 40s. Assuming that he started having children in his teens, his late teens, his boys would have been of an age to pull this kind of thing off in this culture when he was in his late 30s or early 40s. But that's just a guess. Probably should go through and count up the years as they're given to us and see if we can figure it out that way. Another kingly act of David in the midst of his cowardice, if that's not too strong a term, Abiathar and Zadok, the two high priests, the sort of competing high priests during this period, came up with all the Levites, all the priestly class or tribe, carrying the Ark of the Covenant. They set down the Ark of God. The covenant of God. They set down the Ark of God until all the people had passed out of the city. Then the king said to Zadok, carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and the place where it stays. But if he says, I take no pleasure in you, here I am, let him do to me what seems good to you. The king also said to the priest Zadok, look, go back to the city in peace, you and Abiathar, with your two sons, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar carry the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remain there. David manages to separate himself from the religious life. He is not he is not taking what many would regard as his proper position as the religious leader of the land, as kingship. He's not taking that with him. He's leaving the religious symbol, the primary religious symbol, there in Jerusalem, rather than carrying it out with him as it has been used in war, as a symbol of God's favor. And his response is, if I find favor in God's eyes, then he'll bring me back to see it. If he finds no pleasure in me, I'm a dead man anyway. The Ark of the Covenant's not going to make any difference. And again, in 30 and 31, there's more weeping as he passes by, more mourning at this passing of this dynasty, so to speak. And David finds out that Achitophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And he has this little prayer, Oh Lord, I pray you turn the counsel of Achitophel into foolishness. And we won't see that, but that prayer is answered quite directly in chapter 17. And what happens to Achitophel when his advice is not followed, when his actually good advice is not followed, because there's a conspirator from David infiltrates Absalom's camp, Achitophel, which is really an opportunity for Hushai to say to not have to come. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I will be your servant. Then you will defeat for me the counsel of Achitophel. So he has another job for him to do, so that he won't feel obligated to come along. He sends him in as a spy. The priests Zadok and Abiathar will be with you there. So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to the priest Zadok and Abiathar. Their two sons are with them, Zadok's son Ahimaaz and Abiathar's son Jonathan. And by them you shall report to me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. And so he winds up back in, not going with David, but comes back in to enter with the victorious new king. Now, what happens, the beginning of 16 is kind of interesting. David goes up into Benjaminite territory, just a little bit north, not as far north as Geshur is. This is the territory of Saul. Saul's son's servant is there, and he receives him warmly. That's the first four verses. And then the next four verses, I'm going to read this one, although I intended to skip over it. When King David came to Bahurim, a man of the family of the house of Saul came out, and whose name was Shimei, son of Gera. He came out cursing. He threw stones at David and all the servants of the king David. Now all the people and all the warriors were on his right and on his left. Shimei shouted while he cursed, "Out, out, murderer, scoundrel! The Lord has avenged on all of you the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned." Shimei is from the house of Saul. What is the accusation that's being?
Saul is a brother, right? Or half brother?
Now, Saul is the king who preceded David.
Oh, okay.
And David took his place after Saul was killed in battle. Up here in Benjamin, this is the former royal family.
Well, David's being more or less chastised, isn't he, for letting this happen?
Mm-hmm. Or maybe causing it happen. Remember, Saul was chasing David for several years, married into the family, and David married into Saul's family. And then replaced Saul as king as soon as Saul was dead, although not as king overall for 6-7 years for him to consolidate the kingdom. He is chastising, he's calling him a man of blood. He's telling him that you've got your comeuppance. You know, you and Jonathan conspired against Saul. You and Jonathan and Michael conspired against Saul. You rebelled against your Lord, and now your son has rebelled against you. This is, you're getting what you deserved. The next few verses are in that chapter. The servants want to go up and kill this guy, and David says, who knows, maybe God has told him to curse David. And if that's the case, who are we to say anything? David has taken on this really either incredibly wimpy, passive mindset or this unbelievably pious attitude of that seems not to be characteristic of David, of whatever God wants is going to happen. Let him curse him. He seems to have lost all spirit here. So that's the way I read it. But other people see it as a very pious response. Seems to be very defeated.
Now, is he still married to Bathsheba at this time then? Or?
Yeah, she's still part of the household. She'll come up. We won't get to that in these two sessions, but she'll come up at the very end of 2 Samuel when Absalom dies in 18. And then we have another, maybe, is it 10 or 7 chapters? And in the 2 Kings, first two chapters of 2 Kings, David dies, and we finally get Solomon on the throne. And she does a lot of politicking along with one of the priests to get Solomon to be the king, the new king, rather than his older brother, whose name slips my mind right now.
Well, then was Solomon king overall, or do they still have these kings in like Geshur and Hebron and those areas too? Or
yeah.
I guess I wasn't really aware of that.
Well, those, you have to think of those during David's reign more as like states or provinces than separate kingdoms.
They were still under David.
Right.
Like even when Absalom was, he still was responsible to David.
Right. Still Israelite territory, but David is the first king who's really united this. Saul was king up north, and they had some following in the south. David was from the south and married into Saul's family and made a neat political alliance, even though there was bad blood between David and Saul's, much of Saul's family when Saul was dead. And David is the first king. By moving his kingdom up out of Hebron, which is a very definite southern city, it'd be like, all right, we've got a capital in Charleston and we've got a capital in New York. Let's make a capital in Washington, D.C. or Philadelphia. But that's, if D.C. was already the capital for the United States, but if we had needed a neutral place, D.C. kind of turns out to be the spot. So David moved out of that very clearly southern capital into this neutral spot, and therefore could hold together the north and the south, which only a generation before, not even a generation before, had been more or less confederated states, loosely connected, with different leaders coming up as they were needed. Saul is the first king over all Israel that can be called a king, and then David's over the northern kingdom. David's the first one over all of Israel, and I misspoke myself earlier, who can be called king of all of Israel. And then Solomon is the king. You know, we think of the kingdom of Israel, but it only lasted for two kings. So Solomon is king for a long reign. There's a lot of building, a lot of border fortification. But then as soon as Solomon dies, Rehoboam comes along, and he is clueless as to how to manage people. And the people up north say, your father worked us too hard and showed favoritism to the south. How about you fix that? And Rehoboam says, you thought my father was bad. Where do you see what I'm going to do? And they just check out. And that's the split of the Israelite kingdom in the north and the Judah, the kingdom in the south. But the kingdom of United Israel is only for maybe for some of Saul's reign, kind of looks that direction in Saul's reign, but only for David and Solomon. It's a real, real short period. Hushai and 16, end of 16 and 17, into 17, Hushai, who David sent back as a spy, and Ahithophel, who had been part of the conspiracy, give conflicting advice to Absalom as to what the next step should be. Achitophel says, we know where your dad is, or we think we know where he is. Let's go get him. Let's end it now. Nobody dies except for your father, your king, and nobody's going to be ticked off at you about this long, drawn-out war. Hushai says, we're not quite sure where he is. Let's mass the troops. Let's go get him when we're sure we can get him trapped. And then sends word out through Zadok and Abiathar's sons, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, to let David know what the two plans are, so David has a chance to cover himself. David runs a little further out of the way, and there's a neat little trick of covering up a well and putting grain over it, sort of reminiscent of the book of Joshua with Rahab and the two spies from the Israelites that are coming into the promised land. But it gives David a little chance to get away. The conflicting advice stalls the process and gives David a chance. So let's jump over to 18 and see what's going on there. We're going to see a character that we haven't seen in these stories before, Joab, who has been David's right-hand man throughout all of David's campaigns, from the time that he was what I call basically a youth gang leader, hanging out on the edge of the society, making raids to feed his soldiers, fighting sometimes for the Philistines, sometimes for the Israelites, being pretty much a mercenary. And I say that and it sometimes upsets people, but think about some of the leaders of the world in the last 50 years. 50 years ago, Moshe Dayan was a terrorist. 10 years ago, we gave him the Nobel Peace Prize. This is the kind of transformation that David went through. You can go through that. If you could read the English newspapers of 1776, George Washington was a revolutionary, a terrorist. People in Boston were terrorists. We read the stories now. They were statesmen and heroes. It's a matter of what the situation is, how you put the spin on it. Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe was a terrorist 15 years ago. Now he's the prime minister of Zimbabwe and an elder statesman in that country. Over and over, 5 years ago, Nelson Mandela was a prisoner in Robben Island. Now he's the president of South Africa. This is the kind of thing that happened with David, although David was literally on the fighting terrorist mercenary side, whereas some of those people weren't fighters. Dayan was a fighter. Mugabe was a fighter. Who was the last one I mentioned? Mandela was a lawyer, which maybe he should have been in prison. Was there a question?
No.
Can someone read 18, 1 through 5, please?
Yes, I can do that.
Thanks.
But Elad saw them and told Absalom, so both of them went away quickly and came to the house of a man of Ahimaaz, who had a well in his courtyard. And they went down into it, and the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth.
I'm sorry. I want to skip over that. I want to jump to 18. I'm sorry, I didn't say that clearly.
Am I wrong? I get it. Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry.
18, 1 through 5.
Okay. Then David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And David sent forth the army, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Job's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai, the Jethite. And the king said to the men, I myself will also go out with you. How much further must we go?
Two more, through five.
But the men said, you shall not go out, for if we flee, they will not care about us. and if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that you send us help from the city. The king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood at the side of the gate while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king ordered Jael and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with this young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders of all the
army. Okay. Now, what we didn't read in just 27, I'm just going to mention that there's this talk about the food, the troops being, it ends with the troops are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. And David seems to like now snap out of it. When he hears that his troops are hungry, he kind of snaps out of it, musters the men who are with him, and organizes everything and sends them out. This looks like the David that we know from the earlier stories. But at the end here in verse 5, we've got a real morale problem. There's a revolution. These guys are all suited up, ready to go out and fight. And then he calls the three leaders and says, but deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Now, I'm sorry, folks. If I'm about to go out and risk my life, we just heard about, you know, if 10,000 of us die, it makes no difference. But you're too valuable. And to hear from that person, but take care of the one who started this whole mess. I think that's a natural reaction on David's part. But I think it's a real morale problem. And we see later when Absalom does die that it's a real morale problem. To see when David mourned, it's a real morale problem for the troops who were loyal to them, to him.
What do you think the cause of David, you know, he was such a take charge person, then he became very kind of more or less apathetic, and then he start to take charge again then?
That's what it looks like. I'm just guessing, and I'm not trained in psychology, but I think he went through some real serious depression and loss of focus, and his world was turned upside down. But when he got back into a familiar situation, which, you know, the one thing that we know that David was consistently good at is fighting, and his troops were in trouble. He had a real bond, apparently, for his fighting soldiers. When they were in trouble, when they were in need, this is something I can do. This is something I know how to do. And he snaps back into it. Sort of like in times of mourning, you know, mothers make beds, fathers go to their shops and make something with their hands because it comes naturally. Mothers cook, people, you know, do things that come naturally to their whole body, mind, sense when they're mourning. Once they get out of the fetal position and the rocking and the crying, they push themselves into things that they do naturally, that they've done over and over again before. And this seems to be what David knows how to organize troops. So there's a battle, about 20,000 soldiers fighting, and the battle spread over the whole face of the country. I'm reading in 8 now, and the forest claimed more victims than the sword. Yeah, more people got lost and hurt that way, and the biggie comes up in 9 and 10, someone who got claimed by the forest. Someone want to read this?
And Absalom chanced to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding upon his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, and he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him went on. Shall I go on?
Yeah.
And a certain man saw it and told Joab, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. Joab said to the man who told him, what, you saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a girdle. But the man said to Joab, even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not put forth my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and
Ittai,
for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. Joab said, I will not waste time like this with you. And he took three darts in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearer, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him.
Okay. Absalom, I started to say, had been with David from the very beginning, and he has better sense about what's good for David than David does, especially when it comes to personal matters. And once earlier, when Saul's right-hand man struck a deal with David, and Abner saw that it wasn't a good deal. He also had some personal revenge motives. Abner had killed David, or Joab's cousin. But when he saw it wasn't a good deal for David, he's going to have to share power with this guy who was still loyal to Saul's family. Joab just walked up and killed him, even though David had a covenant with him. And here again, David's asked him, for my sake. Joab says, are you crazy? This guy's revolting. Excuse the pun. and we're about to lose thousands of men out here. We're wandering around in the forest. Kill him now. I'm not going to spend time doing this. I'm not going to talk about this. I'll do it myself. Goes right out and runs him through. Sounded the trumpet, told everybody to come back, took Absalom, threw him into a great pit in the forest, and raised over him a great heap of stones. Oh, this is a little problematic because in Israel today you can still go see Absalom's tomb. which is mentioned here, or it's mentioned here. We're not sure that the one that you can go see is the one that he actually built, but the story says he's buried in a big heap to give him no recognition so that he cannot be a martyr.
I didn't realize that he was still alive. I always thought that he just died hanging
from the tree, yeah. But no, there it is. Joab took care of it because he knew that David would let this guy hang around and possibly do it again and do it right the next time. Then they send word back to the king, and David gets the word in 24. It's later than 24. They see the messengers coming. In 33, the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son, Absalom, would I have died instead of you, O Absalom, my son. And then just in the 19, a little bit, it was told to Joab that the king was weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the troops. For the troops heard that day, the king is grieving for his son. The troops stole into the city that day as soldiers steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. They've won the battle, the revolution has been quashed, and they're sneaking into the city. Think about Vietnam. These poor men, when his boys came back as, in many cases, shattered men, having seen horrendous things, tried to serve their country, sometimes by choice, sometimes by force of conscription, and they come back, and instead of being received as people who tried to do the right thing, they're spit upon and things thrown at them. This is the kind of entry that these victorious soldiers make back into Jerusalem this day, after having saved the nation, the king. The king covered his face and cried with a loud voice, oh, my son, Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab came into the house of the king and said, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your officers who saved your life today, and the lives of your sons and your daughters, and the lives of your wives and your concubines, for love of those who hate you and for the hatred of those who love you. Right? You've got it all turned up, turned upside down, your highness. These men risk their life for you, and they come in shame. and the one who hated you and would have killed you in an instant you're mourning for. You have made it clear today that commanders and officers are nothing to you, for I perceive that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. So go out at once, speak to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night, and this will be worse for you than any disaster that has come upon you from your youth until now. And David gets spoken to by one of his servants. Then the king got up, took his seat in the gate. The troops were all told, see, the king is sitting in the gate. And the troops came before the king. So he receives them and essentially thanks them for their service. And then everything's sort of set right. The morale is partially restored. But it's a real kick in the belly to their morale to see the king mourning over the one who was trying to kill him. Not much time to talk about this. We have a few minutes about how true this is and how much being a parent turns one upside down in one's thinking. I don't know what kinds of, my kids are still young, so fortunately they're not causing me this kind of trouble yet. I don't live with them. They live with their mother, and that's another sort of a problem, that sort of grief. But not this sort of rebellion and in-your-face sort of thing. But the cost and the joys of being a parent in these sorts of times is really striking to me in the story of David, in this speech, this last speech from Joab. For the love of those who hate you and the hatred of those who love you. What kind of changes David was willing to go through and how much it depressed him and confused him. When, I guess he tried to live his life through his son. Or his son's life was what gave his life value. And a lot of times we're told that that's the way it's supposed to be. That our children are our heritage. Well, I think there's some truth to that, but the fact of the matter is until they put us in the ground, we still have life left to live. And that's a piece of confusion that we dare not make, that somehow our children and their desires become more important than our own.
But I guess you look at this, you know, what he was sticking with him to the end, and you take, most parents will do that with their children. You know, some people, as you read, boy, they have some tremendous anguish to go through because what their sons or daughters have done. And
yeah.
They get to see them remaining with them.
Yeah. And there's no way to judge him and what anybody else does. And there's no way that anybody else should be allowed to judge what we do. We have to take it in some way to community and to prayer. But if my choice isn't the same as yours, I shouldn't be judging you for your choice to stick with your son or daughter in a particular situation. And if I choose not to do it the same way you do, I expect not to be judged for that because we are different and our callings are different. If my son... Yeah, I think of the people, one of the most terrifying thoughts for me is if there is a war, when my sons come of age, that they would go. Yeah. It's just not my call.
Yeah.
It's just not my call. Or if they should choose not to go, to do something that I think they should do, what kind of influence should I even try? How do you stick with them to the end? And I guess what I'm saying is that it seems to me that every parent's choice, when they make it, is that parent's choice. And we have to trust that they're being as faithful as parents as they can be, rather than say that's not the way to do it and offer support.
We can say that's not the way to do it.
Well, you know,
two might listen to you and the third one might not. Yeah. Or...
And Joab apparently was right. And the other thing is that, you know, sticking with your children is important, but we all live as part of a community. And we can't insist that they live in the community the same way that we do. And when Absalom chose not to live in the community the way that was appropriate, according to the stories as laid out, something had to happen. And Joab was the one who knew what had to happen. David just couldn't see straight. David couldn't do it. David just couldn't do it.
Now, who was Joab?
Joab is David's general.
Okay, but was he the son of just...
His name, his lineage is mentioned here. I don't remember
okay,
when David hooked up with him.
Was some...
Most of David's close associates are not Israelites, which is a pretty amazing thing. You know, all these people who pile through showing loyalty to David are not Israelites, which is another interesting thing about how David solidified the nation.
Joab was a pretty sound advisor to him as you look through here.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Always looking out for David's personal safety and for the good of the nation, where David seems to be blind. David seems to be blind by affection in the case of Absalom, or pride in the case of Absalom when he couldn't bring him back, or loyalty to Jonathan when David was willing to make this unfavorable pact, or not favorable enough pact with Abner. And David, or Joab, takes care of that, gets him out of that one by killing Abner. Joab doesn't get enough credit, and he also gets a bad rap because on David's deathbed, he says to Solomon, kill him. You knowing that Solomon would not be able to handle him, or believing that Solomon would not be able to handle him.
Thanks.
Yeah. As one of my colleagues says, no good deed goes unpunished. There's a ton. These stories are so great. I just want to close again by saying this: the point of reading these stories for me is not to make David look bad. David already is who he is, and we can't change any of that. But to remind us that David and his sons, his family, are no more holy than we are. We just happen to have his story as one of our central stories in the Hebrew Bible. He made as many mistakes, probably more than we'll get a chance to make. And the important thing to remember is that there is grace to cover David, and there's grace to cover us if we have the courage to live and take the risk that God sets before us. So, thanks for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.